if anybody was serious about their faith, I was. You know, if anybody loved Jesus with all their heart, I did. You know, so it's like if what I had wasn't the real thing, then there is no real thing, you know, which is obviously is the end conclusion for me.
Welcome to The X-Files, Stories of Life After God. This special feature of the Life After God podcast explores stories of diverse people who have left the faith and religion they grew up with. Many of the individuals featured in these stories are now atheists, but not all. Some have left fundamentalist forms of religion for something more humanistic. Others have left atheism for some form of spirituality or even religion. In each episode, I will explore the stories of individuals who have undergone significant religious and spiritual transition, the lessons they've learned in the process, and what their life is like now. Some are stories of joy and freedom. Others entail pain and heartache. Most encompass both emotions and more. To learn more about the X-Files and the Life After God podcast, please visit our website at lifeaftergod.org. If you would like to consider sharing your story in a future episode of X-Files, please send me a short email to ryan@lifeaftergod.org and someone will direct you to more information. Today on The X-Files, I speak with Tim Richardson. Tim is a respiratory therapist living in Cabot, Arkansas, not too far from Little Rock. He is married with two young boys. We begin our conversation talking about how religion functioned in his life, what it provided for him, and what spirituality and religion felt like as a young person.
My religious background and upbringing was, to start off with, really largely positive. You know, I didn't have any real negative experiences, at least on a conscious level, which we can get into a little more later. But when I was really young, I less than 10, I was in Baptist churches, mostly, you know, missionary Baptist, and then switched over to Southern Baptist per my parents. My dad grew up in a missionary Baptist church, so that's pretty well where we started, and had my first or my salvation experience in that church. I was 7 years old, and I remember, you know, being taught about Jesus dying on the cross and, you know, how he died to, you know, save me from my sins so I could live in heaven and not hell, you know, the standard evangelical story. And of course, I was very moved and compelled by it and prayed and asked Jesus into my heart when I was 7 years old. And it was a very, very genuine experience for me. I genuinely believed it, genuinely accepted the teaching. And, you know, and it was largely a positive feeling in my life. Felt like, you know, I was, on the right track with my life, that I was right with God, that my life was going to go well. We moved from that church and helped to start my parents helped to start a Southern Baptist church. That church was a little more on the, slightly more on the charismatic side than what we had been used to. And that was a wonderful experience for me. I actually very much enjoyed a little more freedom in worship, you know, like lifting your hands. It was a little more exciting than just stuffy opening up a hymnal and singing a monotone songs and such. But very much enjoyed that. And there, probably around the age of 12 or so, I started getting really serious about my faith, as much as a 12-year-old can, I guess. And very much I enjoyed reading the Bible, enjoyed learning what the Bible had to say about various things, and had a lot of really what I perceived at the time to be, you know, like intimate encounters with God, you know, where worship was a big deal. Felt like I was, you know, experienced God's presence and things of that nature. We were there for probably a good 4 or 5 years, maybe. And I think when I was about 14, we moved on to another church that was even more charismatic. So over time, I bled from a traditional Baptist church into more of a Pentecostal Assemblies of God type of church, and spent my teen years in that kind of setting. And so my religious experiences got even more intense, as you might imagine, and absolutely loved it. I mean, my faith was, as a teenager, was absolutely central to my life. You know, I believed in, I wanted to do everything I could to honor God and live the way God wanted me to. I viewed absolutely you know, every aspect of my life through the lens of, you know, always asking myself the question of how can I best honor God in X, Y, and Z situation. And what it provided for me, you know, I just an enormous sense of hope and comfort, you know, that I had this sense of assurance that I was on the right path in my life, that God was blessing me, that I was going to go to heaven when I die. It was like everything was, for my life personally, was just rosy and sunshine. You know, it was a wonderful experience. And I, you know, there was really, up until late in my teen years, really couldn't pinpoint any real negative experience I'd had in church. You know, I had, you know, wonderful experiences. Always enjoyed church, always enjoyed worship, and even got to the point of being in a charismatic church experience, speaking in tongues, you know, which to a charismatic is kind of like the ultimate evidence, a tangible evidence of God's presence in your life. And it was for me for a long time. It was a very intense experience. You know, my parents were very, religious. They took their faith seriously, but I think as a teenager, I probably took my faith more seriously than they did. It wasn't my parents that pushed me in religion. I really got caught up in it on my own as a youth, but the community within the church was enormous. And actually my teen years, I had several older teenagers and early 20 somethings that were like, we did small groups in the church I went to, and they were small group leaders and they were mentors to me. And I felt like I had very good examples to look up to, and a lot of close friends who were serious about their faith, that we would hold each other accountable for, you know, sins we committed and things like that. But it was an encouraging thing, you know. The community was huge. You know, I just really I remember thinking I didn't keep many close friends in school. I went to church in a different town, not with people I went to school with. So all of my close friends really were through church. And, you know, to this day, still have some close friends, you know, from that period of time.
The process of losing faith is often similar to the process of coming to faith, in the sense that it happens slowly and gradually under the influence of friends, family, or culture. It's often difficult to pinpoint exactly when we started having doubts about our faith or challenges to our belief system or our doctrinal system. Tim is able to put his finger on a couple of really key moments in his life that contributed to his deconversion. He points to the challenges with prayer and the contradictions in the Bible. These are two very common factors in people's deconversion stories. They figure largely, of course, in Tim's story, as you're about to hear. They also figured very largely in my story, as well as the stories of people that I speak to on a regular basis.
Yeah, there's really two points. There's one point where the inkling of doubt kind of started in the back of my mind and I would keep ignoring it, but then there was a later time where it was in my face and I could no longer ignore it. Where I think what was initially started some serious doubts for me was, you know, as a late teenager, probably in my junior year going into my senior year, you know, up to that point, I have been taking my faith very seriously. Like I really believed that, you know, if I prayed the fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much, as scripture says. I believe that if I prayed and wanted to know what God's will for my life was, that God was going to answer me, you know. And so I really genuinely believe that with all my heart. So I was coming up with some important life decisions that a high schooler comes up with, where to go to college and, you know, what career path to pursue. And I really believed God was going to lead me into ministry and such. So, at this point in my life, I think I was starting to notice that when I prayed, that sometimes I would answer my own prayers. And I think even any Christian even, I think, would admit that sometimes they answer their own prayers in their head. But I really wanted to distinguish between me answering my own prayer in my head and God's voice speaking to me, that like I really believed he would. So, you know, when dealing with these hard decisions I had to make, I would pray and just really quiet my mind and intentionally, you know, kind of shut my brain down and wait for God to answer. You know, I took this very literally. And of course, it was nothing but disappointment. You know, after that, when I really tried to distinguish between my voice and God's voice, it was nothing but silence, you know. And it didn't cause me not to believe or to seriously doubt, but it bothered me, you know. And I couldn't reconcile my firm belief that God wants to reveal his will to me with the fact that every time I really tried to engage God and find out and, you know, distinguish between my voice and his, that nothing ever really happened. And when the decision time to make decisions finally came up, it was me that had to make the decision anyway, you know? So, going into early adulthood, I would just was coming to the realization that I was going to have to live my own life and make my own decisions and not wait on some big answer from the sky. And that was kind of the beginning of it.
You said there was a second moment where it was more in your face. What was that about?
Yeah, that was later on, up to about 2 years ago. I actually, from hearing your story, I think we really started our deconversion processes around the same time. And a little over 2 years ago, you know, what started really bothering me is, see, my faith was grounded upon the idea that the Bible was the inerrant, infallible word of God. You know, I really believe that there weren't really any errors and anything that seemed like it, that there was some good answer for it. You know, I took the apologetic approach. And so I've watched this documentary, and this seems, looking back and saying it out loud sounds kind of trivial to me now, but I watched this documentary in which they pointed out certain contradictions in the Bible and made some claims, and it turns out some of the claims they made were really kind of extraordinary and not quite accurate, but still they pointed out some legitimate discrepancies in the Bible. And and it's funny because these were things that I had seen before, I had noticed, but you know, if you're just reading the Bible in a linear fashion, you know, and you come across a seeming discrepancy, it's easy just to ignore it and think, oh, well, there's some reason or some explanation I just don't understand. I'll just ignore it and just kind of glean the overall point of what I'm reading. But then when you start looking at them all together and realizing the totality of the discrepancies in the Bible and how not all of this can be correct, you know, it really started shaking my faith. And then the point – so just the losing my faith in the Bible really was – really the big moment where I really started doubting and asking some serious questions about the validity of Christianity, and then later on even the existence of God. So, and it really was a pretty fast process, but from that point.
And you're not a Christian anymore?
No, not at all. I identify, you know, primarily as an atheist, just to make it clear that no, I do not believe God exists. But I'm certainly not anti-theistic. I am in some senses, but just in general, I don't think belief in God is inherently a bad thing in and of itself, although it can be used that way. But no, I'm no longer a Christian.
And are you're comfortable describing yourself publicly now to your like friends and family as an atheist?
Yeah, I'm more comfortable with it now. I wasn't at first. At first, I was absolutely terrified. You know, I was my first fear was telling my wife. I just knew that if I told her that was going to be the end of my marriage, you know, that was going to be it. So I went for, quite a while, several months, and going through all this turmoil and didn't say anything. I actually got spared the agony of having to tell people myself, because I told my wife first, and it was hard, but things kind of settled down, and she ultimately outed me to everyone in my family and her family. So everyone who was close to me ended up finding out through her. So I didn't really have the opportunity to tell them. But actually now, in hindsight, I'm actually grateful for that, because I kind of got spared that. But I had some hard conversations here and there. But ultimately, it just doesn't come up with my family much. We've talked about it once or twice, and everyone understands where I am. I understand where they are, and we just don't talk about it really. But I have friends that I've mentioned it to at work, and I'm pretty comfortable with if the topic comes up, you know, stating, you know, what my position is.
Navigating family relationships is without a doubt one of the most challenging parts of deconversion. Tim illustrates from his own experience what I've observed in my own and in my conversations with dozens of others. Navigating religious transition with one's spouse depends on both spouses and their attitudes towards their faith and their relationship. Often the greatest credit goes to the spouse who remains in the faith.
Of course, how it's affected my marriage has probably been the biggest hurdle, but I'm really more encouraged because we've come through a lot of hard conversations and a lot of what ifs, and still are doing, you know, pretty well in my opinion. We have some pretty rocky bumps every once in a while, but again, like I mentioned, at first when I was dealing with just my initial doubts and realizing that I didn't think I believed this stuff anymore, there's no way I wanted to tell her. I just really thought she was going to hit the door. And finally, eventually, I gained the courage to tell her what I was going through. And she took it pretty hard at first, and we had some hard conversations. And what I did wrong in the beginning was I came at her with all the logic and stuff that was going on in my head. And she's not that kind of person. She's not a She's very much an experiential person, what something means to her on a personal level. The logic, she could take or leave. It's like she doesn't really care what the logical arguments indicate, you know. So I came at her all wrong at first, and it took some time before I realized that and was able to even I apologize to her that I came at her that way, and I was able to talk to her on a more personal level and explain what I was feeling when I was going through all that. And so that was – so she was able – when I started talking to her that way, she was able to relate to me a lot more and see me started to see me as human again and not some – you know, broken wreck of a husband that she was stuck with. And so the good news, what helps us, I think, is that neither one of us are very dogmatic, and she's especially not. As in her Christian faith, it's all about her personal experience of worshiping God in church, and that's really the only thing she's concerned about. She could take or leave the Bible. She really doesn't care if the Bible is inerrant or not. She doesn't care if any of it's true or not. For her, it's all about her personal experience of God. So that doesn't really hold any sway with her, which is good. So she doesn't have any real strong theological positions that she's just holding on to. It's all about the experience. And so we can actually have some good conversations now about, you know, why people believe this and that based on the Bible. And it, for her, it's neither here nor there. The hardest thing for her, and still is hard for her now, is that our marriage, you know, her belief and my belief then was that our marriage was based upon our mutual faith in God. And then now that was gone, she felt like the very foundation of our marriage has been jerked out from beneath her, you know, so it seemed to make our marriage meaningless in her eyes. But again, it was only about the belief and shared faith in God. It wasn't about any particular doctrine or dogma.
And has she and have the two of you been able to sort of insert a new foundation under your marriage? It sounds like you have.
Yeah, I think it's getting there. And she recently in a conversation told me that, you know, that she was dealing with it a lot better, that she was, you know, seeing me as the same person I've always been again. You know, it's still a big difference for her. And she says it always will be important to her, but that she's happy in our marriage. And yeah, it seems like, I think especially for her, she's starting to see that really this whole time, the foundation of our marriage has been, you know, our love for one another and the things we have in common. And, you know, we get along, we enjoy the same things, we enjoy each other's company, you know, everything else really in our relationship has been great. And I think she's starting to see that that's really been the bedrock of our marriage the whole time. And that this difference, albeit it's a big one for her, is, you know, doesn't necessarily have to doom us. So we're coming around, and I want to say I'm coming around too. I don't want to put it all on her, like make it all one-sided, because, you know, I've had to slowly become more sensitive to the fact that, you know, I never wanted to change her and her beliefs, but I wanted her, of course, to accept where I was. But to do that, I've had to be very sensitive about the fact that if the roles were reversed and I was still strong in my faith and she had lost her faith, I'd be taking it just as hard, if not more so, you know, so being able to sympathize with her, you know, is obviously hugely important on my end.
After a few years, a person is able to look back on key experiences in their life and draw some lessons from those experiences that can bring light and wisdom to others. And so I asked him to share with me some of the key things that he has learned over the past few years about his journey of losing his faith and how he would summarize those lessons for others.
I would say that I came to a point where I began to value truth above my own comfort, you know, and I think that when you get to a point where, you know, you would rather know what's true, even if it means being disappointed, then I think you're in a good place of being able to, you know, objectively evaluate your own beliefs and your own worldview. And so that's something, if I could put it in form of a lesson or advice to somebody, is, you know, no matter what their ultimate conclusion ends up being, you know, don't be able to put your comfort aside and search for truth, you know, and that's, you know, if you really do want to know what's true. And secondly, the big thing, one thing that really stood out to me early on in my deconversion was that I really felt like my deconversion was not a choice I made, you know, and first talking to my wife, she had the hardest time not seeing it as some type of choice. And I understand that completely now, because in Christianity, especially evangelical Christianity, belief is framed in nothing but terms of choice. It's all about choosing to follow Jesus, you know, and you're choosing to ask Jesus into your heart, whatever the phrase is you want to use. And so that's the only way they're taught spiritual belief is in terms of choice. So when someone rejects that belief, they see it as a choice. And I didn't at all. I felt like I was wrestling with these hard questions, and I was looking for answers in order to strengthen my faith. And I felt like my faith just crumbled beneath my feet despite my best efforts, you know. So I certainly didn't choose to lose my faith or give it up. So, you know, distilling that as a lesson, you know, for one, I guess I would say, you know, don't feel like you have to make some kind of decision. Don't feel like you have to decide, you know, whether or not I believe this. Just keep asking questions. If questions come up and you search for answers, you know, search for real answers for them. And if you don't find them convincing, then you don't find them convincing. And that's not a bad thing. You know, it's okay. And take it a step at a time. Don't feel like you have to define yourself in some different way if you're not ready to.
Looking back, what would you say are some of the most damaging aspects of religious faith, especially in your own personal experience?
Yeah, there's a number of things. The first thing that sticks out to me is the fact that this is something I had to learn in my deconversion, that, you know, religious communities are not logic communities. They don't believe what they do for logical, rational reasons. They're moral communities. You know, these are spiritual traditions that are built around senses of what is ultimately important and meaningful and what's good and bad, right and wrong. So it's they're framed on moral bases. So when you that's where the problem lies, because whenever you interpret morality in terms of the will of some being, it doesn't matter if it's all powerful or whatever you define God as, if you view morality as something that comes from the will of some being, it automatically divorces morality from what it's really about, which is human well-being and among other things, but I would say primarily human and sentient well-being. So when you divorce it from that, then morality can be anything. It can be anything that you believe this God says it is. So, and I think that's a huge problem. I think that's why Christians fail to see the moral bankruptcy of the doctrine of hell. You know, they somehow think it's just and right that a God could loving God could condemn people to an eternal hell for finite crimes. They fail to see how that's completely not just immoral. That's the antithesis of morality and the antithesis of justice. It's injustice to the nth degree, and they can't see that because they frame morality in terms of the will of God and not in terms of what it's really about. So I think that's the biggest danger, in my opinion, of religion and faith.
It kind of stunts, like, if I could, like, reflect back to you for a second, tell me if this is what you're saying, that it conservative, you know, sort of Bible literal Christianity in particular stunts moral development because it short circuits the actual moral reasoning process.
Oh yeah, I would say so. And how that affected me personally growing up was that's the only way I was taught to view morality. It was never really a question of what's right and wrong for me. It was always a question of what's God's will in this situation. That was always the question. And in the back of my mind, that was synonymous with morality. But yeah, so I grew up kind of unable, and I was a good kid, don't get me wrong. I mean, I was a moral person. I just I know that that's why that's one of the first things I had trouble with in my early days of doubting as a teenager was that was evangelism. You know, I grew up in an evangelical tradition where one of the most important things was sharing your faith. And I really could bring myself to feel like that was okay. I would do it. I would share my faith with people. I even, you know, led some people to Christ here and there. But it always felt kind of wrong to me. You know, it's like I would always ignore it because I felt like, well, that's God's will. It's the right thing to do. But really, now I don't see it as anything good at all. If you're doing it in a way that's coercive, trying to talk somebody into buying what you're selling, you know, this just, to me, just not right. You know, in the church I was in as a teenager, the real more charismatic one, they got into, you know, they would tell us to build relationships with people, that they wanted us to, like, relationship evangelism, like befriending people and getting into their lives was kind of the buzz phrase they would use. And it sounded all good. It sounded all genuine. But to me, in the back of my mind, it really made it worse, you know, because I'm like, I'm not just going out to sell something. I'm actually trying to convince somebody that I am interested in them as a person and befriend them, really for the ulterior motive of selling them my religion. And that's, to me, it was horrible. I'm like, they're really encouraging me to lead people on in order to get them to believe what I believe. It just feels like that's just completely undercuts the whole, you know, genuine relationship. So that's one of those other moral things where I see is completely immoral now. And but I certainly I didn't at the time, but it did kind of bug me in the back of my mind, and now I understand why. For me, one of the big things was, of course, as a teenager, was just dealing with sexuality and guilt over, you know, if I looked at a girl with lust, you know, I can't, you know, it's funny to me now because they would preach against lust all the time and then wonder why, you know, teenage girls are ending up pregnant. I'm like, well, all you ever talk about is sex in church, then you wonder why everyone's doing it. But for me, you know, I was so serious about my faith. You know, if I, you know, you'd be kind of graphic here, but if I masturbated or something, I felt so guilty. You know, I would bury my face in the carpet and cry and beg God to forgive me for lusting or masturbating or if I looked at porn or something. It was like the end of the world for me. And you know, it's not like at first it wasn't because of anything anybody put on me. I just took the scriptures about lust that seriously, you know. And then later on, towards when I was probably junior in high school or so, I was a small group leader in this church and had a small group of guys I would kind of minister to a little bit. But we had a youth pastor who got real serious about purity and such, and we would have meetings with all the group leaders and accountability meetings about our sexual sins, you know. And looking back now, I mean, this was, you probably classify it as an abuse, you know, that we were, you know, kind of made, you know, made to feel guilty over every little slip up we did. And they, you know, so that it took me a while, even, you know, even into my marriage a little bit to kind of get over that. And I feel like I have now. It's not a, it doesn't haunt me, but it certainly was a trauma I endured.
One of the most frustrating things that an ex-Christian can hear from a Christian is that they never truly believed in the first place or never had a serious relationship with God. Tim, as you can tell so far in this conversation, clearly had a strong relationship with Jesus. He gave his whole life to it in the early days, and gradually it simply didn't make sense to him anymore. But he comments in these closing minutes about how important it is that we take people's experiences seriously and not discount them, to truly enter into the experience of another person and listen to their story, which is really the whole purpose of X-Files. So I hope that you'll take to heart these final words from Tim as he talks about his experience of coming out of his faith and what his life is like now.
You know, these people who are struggling with those doubts need to understand that there are people out there who they took their faith very seriously and they genuinely did believe. You know, like you said, I have been accused of not being a true Christian or whatever, and it's still insulting to me now because when I look back, if anybody was serious about their faith, I was. You know, if anybody loved Jesus with all their heart, I did. You know, so it's like if what I had wasn't the real thing, then there is no real thing, you know, which is obviously is the end conclusion for me. But so I started with things like that, and then I did find a community. I ended up on xchristian.net was a great resource for me, and just because there are people from all sorts of backgrounds from religion who've come out of it and got into some really good, helpful conversations. And when I got a little more bold, got into a lot of debates and things of that nature. And I eventually got tired of arguing and just wanted more, you know, settled down kind of community. And then ended up with, you know, Life After God. And that's been a huge help because I don't have anybody really in person that I can talk to about this stuff in a meaningful way who's been through exactly what I've been through. So it's having a sense of community has been a huge help for me. Overall, I mean, my transition out of religion has something I value it as much in the same way that I valued my initial conversion to Christianity. You know, it's just a step forward in my progression as a person. And, you know, we've been talking about, you know, religion and my experience in it. But just talking about since then, I mean, I have probably a deeper sense of wonder and awe at life and existence in general that I don't think I could have had as a Christian. You know, I've just kind of realized, hey, there's a lot of stuff out here I don't know that I thought I did, and it's wonderful to be able to, you know, pursue real answers to questions and being okay with the things I don't know. You know, I don't have to feel like I have to settle for some secondhand theological answer and forget about it. I can actually explore and look for answers, and if I don't have any, it's okay to say I don't know, and I'm comfortable in that now.
Is that the thing that you think adds to the wonder and awe, the lack of that shortcut answer from theology?
Yeah.
What is it that enables more wonder and awe now than you had before.
Yeah, I think that's precisely it. The fact that there's just so much we don't know. And when you get to a point where you stop pretending to know things you don't know, then you realize that, yeah, I may understand this and that, but there's so much more out there. And yeah, and I think religions by and large probably started out as, at least partially, as explanations for things we didn't understand, you know, and it was a way to understand those things in a way that we could exert control over, you know, by making sacrifices and praying. And those are all just ways that we attempt to control things we know we can't control. And so we like to settle for these simplistic answers because we hate not knowing. It's ingrained in human nature to hate not knowing. And I listened to a debate with Matt Dillahunty one time, and so sometimes he gets a little too firebrand for me, but he made a really good point. So he was debating science with a Christian, and the Christian got frustrated and finally asked him, he's like, well, don't you hate not knowing? And he didn't even miss a beat. He said, yes, I hate not knowing, but that's why we have science. That's why we have these mechanisms to inquire and find real answers to these questions instead of just settling for the simplest and most comforting answer we can find. And to me, that just hit the nail right on the head as far as awe and wonder, is now that I don't feel the urge to settle for those simplistic, comforting answers, you know, I'm, you know, free to think for myself, free to evaluate evidence and not have to settle for anything an authority says.
Thanks so much, Tim. I really appreciate you, you know, being so vulnerable and just kind of sharing your experience. And, you know, I know it'll be super valuable for others.
Oh, yeah. You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for tuning in to this inaugural episode of The X-Files. Thank you to Tim Richardson for taking the time to talk with me about his story and for sharing so vulnerably, not only about, you know, philosophical things and the things that went through his head, but also the very personal and intimate details of his family life and the way that his change of mind and change of heart about these issues that have been core to his life and his wife's life have affected all of them. Major props to all the members of his family for navigating these waters so carefully with him. I want to say thank you again to Ian Gordon for providing the music for The X-Files. You can learn more about Ian's music in the show notes. We'll see you back here Wednesday for the next episode of the Life After God podcast. I'll be talking with my friend Zeke Pystrup about his work on the film Apocalypse Later, Harold Camping versus the End of the World. Until then, you can learn more about Life After God at our website, lifeaftergod.org. If you'd like to be considered to be a guest on The X-Files in the future, please drop me an email at ryan@lifeaftergod.org. You can subscribe to all of our social media through our website. All the links are there. And if you can make a financial contribution to keep our podcast growing and successful, we definitely need your support. You can go to patreon.com/lifeaftergod and make any size recurring donation to support the work that we're doing in telling these stories and giving some encouragement and hope to those that are new in the journey. Thanks again for tuning in. My name is Ryan Bell, and this has been The X-Files on the Life After God podcast.